This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, April 19th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Abigail and present an interview with Radio Silence, the directing duo behind the movie. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
All right, BJ, before we start, I wanted to read some quick feedback from our vampire episode that Chris and I did yesterday. Eddie from LA wrote in saying, thanks for another fun episode. Most of my favorite vampire movies at least got a shout out, but I do recommend 2012's Byzantium, directed by Neil Jordan, who also directed Interview with a Vampire, and it stars Saoirse Ronan and Gemma Arterton. It is a more realistic take while still having style, and it covers some themes that you won't likely find in other vampire tales. I've always thought this was underrated and underseen, so check it out. And of course, where was Vampire's Kiss? We definitely did not mention the Nicolas Cage movie Vampire's Kiss. BJ, have you seen Byzantium? This is one that I have not seen.
I have seen Byzantium, and I'm so glad that someone messaged in about it because I agree. It is super underrated and criminally underseen.
Awesome. Do you have, real quick, any just favorite vampire movies off the top of your head?
Listen, I have a lot of movie tattoos on my body. And for those that don't know, three of them are in references to vampire movies. I have Morse code on my left arm for Sweet Dreams, which is the first thing that Oscar teaches Ely to write in Morse code in Let the Right One In. I have a portrait tattoo on my right forearm of Countess Maria Zaleska, aka Dracula's daughter, my like all-time favorite of the Universal Monsters. And then I have a massive thigh piece of a fruit bat who has taken a giant bite out of an apple while wearing a red scarf, and that is my Chris Sarandon Jerry Dandridge Fright Night tattoo, because I have so many Fright Night posters in my office that I should probably be studied.
Amazing. Okay, that's great. At least one of those we did not mention on yesterday's show. So there's another one for people to check out if they're creating some sort of massive vampire movie list or something like that. Let's talk a little bit about Abigail. Actually, before we do that, let's talk about Radio Silence, the filmmaking collective, I guess you could describe them. They have directed several things over the years. They started out doing short films. Their first, I guess, live action effort was a segment in the original VHS movie. And they've made things like Devil's Do and Radio Not, Scream, and then Scream 6. They also directed some segments in another anthology horror film called Southbound. And now they're here with Abigail. So what do you think about Radio Silence as a group of horror filmmakers, BJ?
I love Radio Silence. They really tap into my specific brand of horror stuff that I really like because all of their outings are fun. Even in the stuff that is like very, very intense. I was actually talking about this with a friend earlier today where the first VHS movie, there's a lot of intense stories in there, but in the one that they're doing, you know, they're coming to a party, blasting ska music. And that's because that goes into a whole thing with, you know, Radio Silence and their history with ska music. But that's something that really resonates with me because I'm a fucking loser who loves ska music. I don't think I'm a loser. I just understand the general public thinks that I'm a loser, begging people to stop past Real Big Fish. But that's an entirely different podcast. So they always have an era of fun that hangs over everything that they do. And I think that we need that. There is obviously always going to be a space for horror to be a reflection of the anxieties that people are feeling at the time and whatever is scaring us all socially. That's just the history of horror. But the fact that they are like, yeah, we're going to be scary and we're going to dive into these things, but we're also going to have fun with it. It's such a breath of fresh air, especially in our current landscape where everything is just, here's another metaphor for trauma. And it's like, we get it. We all started therapy in 2020. I got it.
Yeah.
So their ability to be like, yeah, we're just going to blow shit up and it's going to be awesome and get on board or get out. I love that. I love that.
Yeah. I was trying to think of, like, technically speaking, maybe what that's a great answer, by the way, but I'm trying to think of, like, something that makes them stand out from other horror directors who are working right now. And one of the things that I kept coming back to, and I was trying to think about this while I was watching the movie, is like, they're really good at blocking big groups on screen. A lot of times when directors, you can kind of feel them like drowning in big casts sometimes, where it's like people don't really know how to frame six characters in the same shot at once or whatever. And Radio Silence, I feel like, does a really good job of, you just feel like they've thought through every shot in all the movies that they're making. You know, nothing feels haphazard or slapdash. It all feels, I've heard like Rian Johnson talk about how that's one of the big challenges of making like the Knives Out movies, is that there's just so many characters. And I feel like in a lot of the stuff that I've seen from Radio Silence anyway, it just seems like they're always dealing with like big ensembles, and they never really feel like they're out of their league, you know, with cast sizes that big. So that was one thing I thought of.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's also because, I mean, they also have a history with doing a lot of comedy, you know, before horror became kind of their forte. When they were doing stuff like the Chad, Matt, and Rob stuff, they were doing comedy. And what is comedy if not ensemble work? And so they take a lot of the stuff that they know about working with ensembles and then put it into horror movies, which all of like the great like the slasher movies, those are all ensemble movies that happen to get smaller. And I love the way that it feels like such a nice interwoven, I don't know, I'm just making up words at this point. It just feels like they are taking a lot of different styles and putting it into horror, which I think is, again, really, really refreshing. It feels like these are horror filmmakers that are inspired by other forms of entertainment and not just horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important distinction as well. It's kind of like the when you say that, it reminds me of like Chad Stahelski and the John Wick movies. Like there's so many, you know, allusions to like different types of art and stuff sort of embedded throughout those films, that it's clear that he has a foundation of watching action movies and being obsessed with Jackie Chan and all that kind of stuff, but it's not the only interest set that he has.
So. Oh, totally. And that's why I become the Joker every time someone's like, this movie is just this, but John Wick. And I'm like, you are forgetting decades of martial arts movies and stunt movies. How dare you?
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into our thoughts about Abigail. I think we can maybe start out with just some spoiler-free stuff, and then we'll get into some more spoiler stuff like right after the break. So I guess we can talk about the marketing, because the marketing revealed the fact that Abigail is a vampire. And I've seen a lot of folks in our Slash Film Slack channel and outside in the wider social media sphere or whatever, people have sort of lamented this and wondered if there might have been a way for the studio to preserve that surprise for people, because just people are just imagining how amazing the experience of watching this movie would have been going in and thinking that it was just like some sort of crime thriller where a little girl gets kidnapped and then revealing whatever an hour in that she's actually a vampire, and just like that tonal shift would have been kind of an amazing surprise to preserve. I'm not sure if there's really enough material there for Universal to have been able to do that realistically. I love that idea, obviously, of the surprise. That would have been amazing, but I don't know. What do you think about like the way that this movie has been presented to audiences, BJ?
Yeah, I think there was no getting around it, because, like you said, there isn't a whole lot ahead of time. And also, if you don't show the reveal that she is a vampire in the marketing, then this just looks like the usual suspects, but they're kidnapping a child. And it is very impossible to get an audience to be on board with, like, yeah, you know what movie I want to see this weekend? That movie where a bunch of adults kidnap a 12-year-old. Sounds like a great time to have this weekend. No, that sounds horrible. But I do think that the marketing was very wise in what they showed of her as a vampire, because it does look very fun. And, you know, without spoiling anything until we get into spoiler territory, the trailers did hide quite a bit, because I remember seeing a lot of people complaining on, you know, Twitter and TikTok, oh my God, the trailer showed everything. And then I saw the movie and I was like, no, it did not. There's plenty of stuff that's hidden in there. So I think they did a pretty good job with it, but it does feel a little bit like a lesson was learned from Megan, which is that you get something kind of gimmicky at the front and people get really hype about it, and then they turn out because they want to see how it's going to go down. I've written an article before on Slash Film about how I am a person that is really unaffected by spoilers, because for me, it's not about reveals. It's how they get there and what they do with it. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that Abigail was a vampire, like, I felt myself getting excited during, you know, this first, you know, 40 minutes or so, when the rest of the team doesn't know she's a vampire yet, where I was like, oh, you fools, you have no idea what's coming for you. This is going to be great.
Yeah, I felt similarly this time, because I typically do like, you know, the feeling of being surprised and stuff like that. But I didn't feel like it really diminished my enjoyment of this movie, which I liked quite a bit. I think this movie kind of rules. I, because of what you said, they did actually a really good job of preserving a lot of the bigger moments. Like, a lot of times with stuff like this, I'm just kind of like sitting there and in my head going through this checklist of like, all right, I saw this in the trailer, I know this is coming, XYZ. You can kind of like draw the line to finish the movie. And it sometimes when the movie is bad, it feels like it's basically just connecting dots that you don't even need connected. It's just kind of like wasting time almost. But this, there's like so much, especially in the back half of the movie that we'll talk about in a little bit, that really like goes pretty wild. So I was excited to see that. I really enjoyed this movie. I think you reviewed it from the Overlook Film Festival, right?
I did. I am so, so privileged to have been able to see the world premiere of Abigail at the Overlook Film Festival. I ran back to my hotel afterwards to write my review. I did give it a perfect 10 out of 10, and I stand by it. I rewatched Abigail in the theaters last night. I went to a much smaller theater so that my wife could see the movie. And I will admit, when I sat down, I was like, oh my God, I really hope that I still feel the same way about this movie and that it wasn't just like the convention world premiere high. And I came home and I was like, nope, I stand by it. That's still a 10 out of 10 movie for me, because the way that I review movies is, what are the filmmakers trying to do? What are they trying to achieve here? And did they achieve it? And I also don't like to compare movies to other movies, because I think that that's foolish, because movies should be judged on their own individualistic merits. And so I was like, nope, they did everything they set out to do. They did it well. I had a great time. I would have changed nothing. I'm happy. 10 out of 10.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we both really dug it. We've definitely recommended and seeking it out if you're even remotely interested in horror stuff, because there's some pretty incredible imagery in this movie that I won't be forgetting for quite some time. Let's take a break and then we'll get back into some spoiler stuff.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
All right, so what are the biggest moments or scenes that you think we should talk about here before we get to your interview with Radio Silence, BJ?
I have to shout out comedic legend Kevin Durand. Oh my God. Like, every time he did anything, I was like, I love him. I would die for him. He's the greatest. He's so funny and just nailed absolutely everything. So like he has a couple of like good one-liners, but just like as such an overall surprise for me, because I'm so used to him playing these giant brutes that with like aggressive nature, and to see him just get to be like a silly fun guy was such a treat. love him dearly.
Yeah, I guess became aware of him first in Lost, in the TV show Lost. And he is one of those sort of, yeah, like aggro heavy characters that you're talking about. And he just kind of seems like a glump for like an oaf or something in this movie in a way. Like,
I love him.
And he's supposed to be the muscle, but he just kind of like seems like almost like a cartoon character in you know, like those I'm trying to think, is it Looney Tunes or something where there's always like a little guy who's like, you know, fast talking or whatever. And there's always just this kind of like big goofy guy who just like is the muscle and follows him around. And is like, yeah, yeah, boss. Yeah. Like that kind of thing, you know, it's like that kind of vibe, I think, from him. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. I mean, all the explosion, every time a vampire was killed in this movie and just exploded into goo, I was so thrilled because I was not expecting any of that. Like none of that is in the trailers really. And just the violence of those explosions, the fact that they really went there, like they covered the entire room in blood and viscera and all that stuff. I was like really very taken by just how hard they went in that sort of over the top goofy bloodiness of it all. What did you think about like the gore factor?
It really feels like Radio Silence is like, did y'all like the ending of Ready or Not? What if we gave you that for like 35 minutes, which is such a delight. They're like the gore in this movie. Again, it's so fun. Like they're not like, it's definitely gross because gore is always gross, but it is fun. It doesn't have like a mean spirited thing. Even when like people's heads are falling off, or you know, she's stabbing him with a necklace and then rubbing the blood on her face, you're not like, ew, gross. You're like, awesome. Like that's how this movie feels. Like this is such a hell yeah movie for me, where like at least, you know, five or six times in this movie you just want to shout like hell yeah brother, like at the screen, because it's so fun. But yeah, the gore factor is just, it's so, this movie is so bloody and it works so beautifully. I mean, Dan Stevens just having his year of playing weird little guys, and I love this for him. But when he's covered in blood and is a vampire and is so cocky, he looks like Severin from Near Dark, and you can only achieve that if you just drench him in blood. And I'm so glad they did.
Yeah, I mean, like, just the sheer number of characters who get turned in this movie was a surprise to me, too.
Oops, all vampires.
Yeah, it really kind of felt that way. And, like, it felt like such a cool opportunity for these different characters, these different actors, I should say, to be able to, you know, show off different ranges and stuff. Like Catherine Newton's in particular, you know, she's like this sort of archetypal little hacker girl, basically. And then she gets turned and she gets to, you know, bust out some ballet moves, and just like her entire character gets to change and she gets to show a different side of herself as a performer that I really appreciated. And same could be said for Dan Stevens. I feel like he was really leaning into the sort of like evil baddie of it all. But yeah, I just like had a lot of fun with, and that seems to be a word that we keep coming back to here with this movie.
It is so fun. I mean, what, I just don't understand, how can you not fall in love with a movie that has Catherine Newton doing vampire glamour ballet to Danzig? Are you shitting me? Like, it's like somebody, I know I say this a lot, and I definitely said this about Lisa Frankenstein, and the same thing kind of goes with Abigail, where it's like somebody like dove into the recesses of my brain. It was like, what is a combination, if we could Mad Lib a scene, that is specifically going to make BJ Colangelo extremely happy, and Catherine Newton vampire glamour to Danzig while also like having this like Southern Belle like, oh no, he died sort of, like, yeah, that's all I want, that's all I ever want, it's perfect.
Oh man, yeah, great stuff. Just a really, really enjoyable movie watching experience. I watched it in a theater that was pretty empty. I think there were only two other people in the theater with me, so it was not like a raucous theatrical experience, but I was just like having a blast by myself in my row. And I'm sure that was like totally opposite of your experience seeing it at a world premiere. Yeah, I guess like before we get to the interview, any other moments or aspects that you wanted to shout out real quick?
I love that all of the vampires have different teeth. I think that that is so smart, and it allows all of them to be very personal. You know, Abigail's teeth, like, they are very almost shark-like. When we see, like, Lambert's teeth, they're, like, very jagged, and they have multiple points with each tooth. I thought that was just a very, very unique thing, and it also adds to the realism because teeth are going to look different in everybody's mouths. And given that Abigail is a 12-year-old, obviously you can't fill her with the same teeth that you would a full-grown adult. And I think that that was just a really interesting choice. I also love that they went full mouth fangs, which is very Fright Night, which is my favorite sort of, like, face. Like, they used to call the Fright Night teeth shark mouth teeth. So to see that in this movie, like, really delighted me. But I also love how much vampire lore this movie plays with, between the things that vampires can and cannot do, the fact that, you know, there is a pulse with a vampire, because that's why you have to kill vampires with a stake through the heart, because there's other people blood pumping through them. I was like, that's a really smart choice. And the fact that you also see the difference between biting a vampire and turning them into sort of your puppet that can do your bidding versus getting a bite and also your first feed being with vampire blood, which allows you to be an autonomous vampire. Not a lot of movies are willing to, like, really unpack the different lore that exists within vampire stories, and to see all of it kind of rolled into one, I thought was just very, very smart. And it allowed me to kind of stay on my toes and figure out where they're going. And it didn't feel predictable the way that I think a lot of vampire stories tend to be, because they do rely on just very basic lore. I just thought it was really, really smart. And oh my God, Catherine Newton bringing in onions made me laugh so hard. Like, I knew the joke was coming the second time, and I still cackled because it's perfect.
Yeah, and I think that goes to, that underlines, like, the sense of surprise that I got anyway, watching those bodies just explode into goo, right? Is because some of the rules didn't apply. And so when something actually does, and it's all that more, you know, that much more surprising. So I really appreciated the way that they sort of, like, tweaked your expectations in that regard too. All right, let's get to your interview with Radio Silence.
Hello, nice to meet you,
Sarah, BJ. Tyler.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Good, how are you?
Really good. Good to see you.
Good to see you both in person, yeah, finally. Yeah, so that's wonderful. All right, so my first question for you is that the Universal Monsters are sort of the building block, I think, of all horror movies. Any story, regardless of subgenre, you can trace back to some theme in a Universal Monster
Very
movie.
Well,
thank you. Yeah. But vampires have never waned in popularity. They've always consisted. We're not seeing as many, you know, Gilman movies these days. We're not seeing as, well, we're getting more Wolfmen these days, which is cool. But vampires have never stopped. What do you think it is about vampires that have made it so that they continue on, you know, over 100 years later?
That's a great question. Jeez. I mean, I think there's just something kind of romantic about them in a weird way that I think is always alluring. But I also think, I know for us, there's something that is very, the mythology is sort of open. There's, like, mm-hmm. a wide mythology. And I think that that allows the vampire lore to be reinterpreted different ways over and over and over. So you can have, like, a Dracula, you can have Dracula's daughter, you can have Lost Boys, you can have Near Dark, you can
have What We Do in the Shadows.
What We Do in the Shadows. And they all live under the same banner of the same, like, monster, but they're all wildly different. And I think that ability to be reinterpreted over and over and over in different ways keeps it fresh and keeps it exciting. And yeah, I mean, there's probably something much deeper, but
I think there's something too, like, there's an intimacy with that monster. The fact that, you know, they can change and sort of, you know, turn on and off that those monster qualities, and that they can seem as one thing but be something else entirely. I think that there's something specifically chilling about that, you know, and I think that lends itself to that sort of romantic notion, but yeah. There's just
it's like a sadness.
Yeah, there's just something really, really scary about that, and I think that it's really evergreen.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I'm glad that you brought up how vampires, like, they have lore. There are certain rules that I think people are programmed to believe, similarly to, you know, everyone knows how to kill a zombie, you shoot it in the head. We've understood that at this point. But I love that the lore interpretation does exist, because you're dealing with a child vampire. Yeah. And I think for most people, their immediate association is, like, Interview with a Vampire, where it also doubles as this tragic story, because you have this, you know, somebody trapped in the body of a child, but could be 100 years old. So what is the vampire lore for Abigail? Will she stay a child forever? Or could we see her eventually, you know, be an angsty teen vampire? Could she be, you know, a quarter life crisis vampire?
I'd show up for all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as Alicia Weir's in the driver's seat, we're there. We're there for that experience.
We've had a few people ask us, like, oh, are you guys talking about a sequel? Which we're not, and we haven't talked about. But when we do joke about it, we're like, well, Alicia's getting older, and how do you do that? So maybe this is the trick. We just do, like, Alicia getting older as a vampire.
I mean, I think that that's perfect, personally, because if you do take the lore of, you know, Universal's original Dracula's Daughter, my favorite Universal monster movie, she is an adult. So, and she talks about, like, oh, my father was Dracula. And it's like, okay, so you were born to this man. We understand this here. So you definitely have that space. And I do think we need more angsty teen vampires outside of Twilight. For sure, we do. And I'm also glad that you are both so on board with Alicia, because I think she's phenomenal.
Oh my fucking god.
She's unbelievable.
Have you seen the movie yet?
I've not seen the movie yet, but I've seen Matilda, and I am all on board.
After this, you're gonna blow your fucking mind.
I can't wait.
And it's one of those things, and you know, I think what you're saying too about the enigmatic nature of a child vampire, I think for us, we knew intellectually, like, just the challenge of, okay, well, we have to cast someone great for this role. And, you know, as we've sort of unpacked it over the course of making the movie and then watching it, the challenge that Alicia had in this movie, that she has to play someone who feels innocent, vulnerable, all of those childlike things, but in an instant you can also read it as, holy shit, there is a maturity, there is an intelligence, there is a soul in this body that is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. Those things all have to be operating simultaneously.
From both point of
views. And she just got the assignment. And I mean, we just can't say enough about how remarkable and how talented she is.
She had to do this.
I can't wait. I think, like, she was such a perfect casting. When I saw the trailer for the first time, I immediately, like, obviously the adults are all people that I know, love, am thrilled to see anytime they come up. But I was like, oh, they got Matilda. And because who is Matilda if not Carrie White with less religious trauma? Like, it's the same character, the same intellect, same powers, same maturity. So, like, she's perfect to play this. But I do want to talk about the dance as well. I don't look like it anymore, but I was a dancer and competitive baton twirler for 20 years. So I'm very familiar with dance. And dance is really difficult to film, because either you move the camera too quickly and then it loses a little bit of its grace, or you pull the camera a little too far away and then it looks like a dad holding a phone at a recital. So what challenges did you have to overcome in having her be a ballerina and making sure that it looked fluid for this movie?
I mean, we just talk about Alicia all fucking day, because she was a ballerina in the script, and I think when you meet her in the first page of the script,
it's like a texture.
Yeah, it's like she's finishing up at a, what do you call it?
It's like at a practice.
Practice.
Studio. Rehearsal.
Yeah. Rehearsal studio. Yeah. Sorry. At a rehearsal studio. And then the movie just kind of goes on. Mm-hmm. And then when Alicia got cast, she was like, I'm a good dancer. I can really dance. We're like, oh, fuck, we should blow this out. Like, we should really, like, lean into that. That's fun. And then our production designer Owen suggested this great theater to shoot instead of a rehearsal studio. And we were like, oh, okay, great. So the pieces start kind of going together, and you take a bird's eye view and you go, oh, my God, we really need to lean into this. This is fun. So then Belinda, who was the choreographer, worked with Alicia for
eight weeks
to really get her, like, up to snuff to be able to do all the actual, like, be on point and all that kind of stuff. And then I think when we're filming it, it's it's about making it feel graceful but still fit the movie. So it doesn't feel, you know, it's kind of what you're saying about the dad holding the thing, so that it never feels like we're just showing off that she can dance, that mm-hmm. it really is in the world, but treating it sort of like action, honestly, yeah. at mm-hmm. the end of the day. And like, it's just another part of the action and not separate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's something...
There's also another dance part later that works out for you.
Good.
Yeah, I think, and you'll see, I mean, the movie opens with a bit of, like, very classical ballet that it has this sort of, I mean, this kind of beautiful imagery of a ballerina, right, is that they feel so, it feels so effortless and it feels so mm-hmm. graceful, but there is more strength and dedication that it takes to just to present that. And there was something so fun about the sort of duality of that. And so you see, yeah. you see Alicia dance very early in the movie, and that feels very classic. And then throughout the action sequences, we were always just looking for interesting ways to incorporate the idea of dance into the chases and the various sort of, you know, fight sequences. And that was just a really cool and fun texture to have the choreographer on set. We'd be like, what if it was this instead? And she'd talk to Alicia, and then they'd show up and we'd do a take where Alicia's like now doing some crazy dance thing. And, I mean, it was amazing to be able to improvise action the way that you would sort of improvise dialogue.
Totally.
But just by incorporating these dance elements into it. It was so fun to watch it all take shape.
We also made sure to kind of tie it in thematically so that the idea of her putting on a show and her kind of being in control
mm-hmm.
is there from the start in the way that she's performing by herself. And then letting that kind of inform the, like, oh, right, this is all. You know, I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but you've seen the trailer. Like,
mm-hmm.
she's orchestrating this thing, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah. She's playing with her food, so
exactly,
to speak.
Yeah.
So that's perfect. And I also think this is such like an untapped avenue, because after The Cabin in the Woods came out and they have that one shot
yes.
of the ballerina
yeah.
with the teeth face, everyone was like, wow, what a great visual. And then no one did anything with it. I was like, why did we not suddenly get ballerina horror movies? Why did it take this long? So kudos for doing that, for finally being the ones to pick up that mantle. But I do also want to talk about the adults in, you know, the adults in the room, because you do have so many, you know, beloved genre folks. And something I found really funny is I was watching a TikTok the other day where someone was like, I really want to see this movie, but why is Elon Musk here? And I was like, why does everyone think Kevin Durant is Elon Musk? So was that an intentional style choice, or is that just happy accident?
Just a happy accident. That's just Kevin, who gets mistaken for Elon. Yeah, I mean, it happened in Ireland a handful of times.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, somebody in a Tesla hat came up to him at a bar
Stop.
One night and said, oh, my God, is that his yacht outside?
Oh, what a cross to bear. I'm so glad that you all are working with Melissa Brera again, who is just unbelievable, such a talent. And that made me think about, you know, I think the general movie-going public probably knows you best for the Scream movies, mm-hmm. but y'all have done so many wonderful original things. Was Abigail your, like, was this the moment where you were like, we have to say goodbye to Scream, move on to something a little bit more original, or were you looking for something original, or how did this become the next project for you?
I mean, I think we're always on the hunt for that exciting original idea, and I mean, we were so fortunate and so grateful to have got to play in the Scream legacy. I mean, those movies, they changed
yeah,
our lives
on.
As viewers, as
mm-hmm.
fans, and then I mean, our lives changed in profound and wonderful ways getting to make two movies. But I think that, you know, leaving that franchise to go do something that was big and original, and we had the faith of the studio in us to like actually take this character and this monster that's been around for a long time and just do something really weird and wild and unexpected with it. I think the energy of that is just, it can't be matched. I mean, you know, the compass for us wasn't like, oh man, how are the fans gonna like this? Every day it was, oh man, do we like this? Is this weird enough? Is this bloody enough? Is it funny enough? Is it scary enough? And when you're working on something original, and that's your North Star, it's all about just your sort of taste. There's just something really gratifying and wonderful about that experience.
Yeah, it's really creatively fulfilling to be able to create something new. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's not to take anything away from Scream, but it is like with Ready or Not or something where it didn't exist. And then we got lucky enough to make it. And we're like, wow, that's a thing we made. And, you know, I think we just feel good about that. Yeah. And Abigail definitely steps it up in that direction.
Was there a relief of pressure? Because I love the Scream movies. That fandom can be something else. And the expectations that a lot of people have for the franchise can be a huge pressure. Was it a pressure removed to work on something original? Or was it added pressure because, oh, now we have to remind people why we are good filmmakers and they're not just showing up because this is the IP they are really into?
I think there's a little bit of, correct me if you feel differently here, but I feel like for Scream 6, we sort of went into it with that mindset.
Yeah, like we spent much like an original.
Yeah, like Scream 5, we were very much like, we have to be beholden to the franchise and we have to do it justice and we have to kind of like bring it back for a new generation. And then with Scream 6, we were like, cool, we did that. Now let's do our thing. And I think that rolled into Abigail, where that reminded us how much we love that. And so with Abigail, we were like, yeah, we can do anything we fucking want. And, you know, like Tyler mentioned a second ago, the studio was really supportive of it and really supportive of not being beholden to anything, not being beholden to old Universal Monster movies to make this wholly new and unique in ours. And I think it did. It allowed us to kind of like, you know, flex those muscles that we hadn't been able to in the Scream movies and just kind of like swing for the fences.
Nice. Wonderful. So did you all know when you cast Dan Stevens that he was going to be having the year that he's having? Or again, is that a happy accident as well?
I mean, a happy accident. We've been fans of Dan for so long and it feels like he's one of those great actors that is in everything and is memorable in everything that he touches.
He's
and
so fucking good.
We can't, yeah, he is, I mean, he's just like a unique talent. By the way, like in a cast of unique talents, like he is just one of the most remarkable, you know, actors we've ever worked with. And he is,
don't tell him we said
that. And he is, and look, he gets, I think the thing about Dan is he gets the tone. And I think that was one of the things that we were just so grateful to have him on set, just, you know, guiding us in some respects. You know, he just understood this character to a degree that I think wasn't on the page. And you want that and you hope for that, right? That your cast brings something really unique that sort of exists outside of what the confines of the script are. And Dan and everybody really, like, really bring it in a way. We talk all the time about how the goal for us is by the end of making the movie that when you watch it, you go, what would this have been if we cast someone else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that really is just having faith in ourselves to choose great cast, but then also building a relationship with the cast so they feel safe making the craziest, weirdest choices that they can make. And you end up with a really bespoke, bizarre ensemble that is just so fun to watch.
He also, Dan's preparation, I don't know what his process is, but his preparation when he comes in on set is so maxed out. And he's able to, because he's so good, he's able to improv in a way that I think made us so happy every day. Because we're like, oh, fuck yeah, he's making this like just come alive in a way that is, you know, it's like it's not on the page necessarily, but he's able to turn on a dime. He like surprises you at every moment. It's one of those like his charisma, you just can't stop watching him. And I mean, we felt that way when we see him in everybody else's movies.
We saw him in The Guest, honestly.
Right, yeah.
You know, we saw that. That was like
our so many people to watch The Guest in like the last 5 years. I'm like, who's this handsome guy? And I'm like, you want to see him be a Terminator? Let's go.
It'll be a funny little Easter egg for you in this
movie. Good. Oh, yeah. I'm going to mark out real hard. I'm very excited. I'm very excited. And so then you also, you know, you have Melissa Brer and you have Catherine Newton, who are both, you know, the phrase Scream Queen, I know, is a little touchy with some people, but they are sort of these new beacons for horror fans of a younger generation, like those are their Jamie Lee Curtises, so to speak. Yeah. So what is it like for you as filmmakers to be the people who are able to continue this pathway for both of them to solidify their place as these, you know, these now legacy horror people that we'll be talking about until, you know, I'm 80?
I mean, we feel really lucky.
It's an honor.
Yeah. It's, I mean,
they're great because they're both so smart and they understand and love the genre. And so I think so much of what's great about that to us is we get to learn from them, right? That we trust them because they understand why the genre is great and how to be mm-hmm. great in the genre. And so I think there's something really humbling about working with, you know, both of them, where you give an idea and you see it go through that filter of like, yeah, this is interesting. I haven't done this before. I haven't seen this before, because they just know so much mm-hmm. about that world. And so you get these really fun, unique choices.
And they're really fun together because they're both different, you know.
Very different flavors.
They're different. Yeah, they bring something wildly different to it. And to see them together and to kind of watch their relationship in the movie, it's really fun because it's not just like, you know, I think we're really used to like the one person who's going to, you know, and this, they get to kind of come together and it's just, it's neat to see that. I also think it's, just to talk about Catherine for a second, I think it's really funny. She keeps saying that we never said no to her, which is true. And it's, but it's part of her like special skills that she has all these great ideas. And one of the things that we've learned over the years is if you trust somebody to feel comfortable, to have a great idea, and then to see it through, we'll be there if it goes off the rails, that's fine. But almost always, it makes the scene better.
Yeah, and even if you don't necessarily use that specific choice, the path to it usually reveals something else that's totally really great and really usable. And I think that's that trust that we just try to find and build.
Yeah.
Because you never know like when that like that next take is gonna be the golden, like, 100%. Wonderful thing.
And it was also really fun with Melissa to be able to do, you know, it's still like, yeah, like Scream Queen, but in a totally new way mm-hmm. from what we had done in the previous two movies with her.
Perfect. So I have time for one last question. So I'm going to ask you both, if you had to be a part of any vampire coven gang from another horror movie, which one are you signing up to join?
Lost Boys.
Yeah. I should have said, but I didn't want to assume. Boring, like, I mean, you get to hang out under the pier where there's like, you know, a carnival. You also cool get Chinese food. You get motorcycles, leather jackets. Like, leather, that's really cool.
I lived in San Cruz for college, and that was like, as soon as I got there, I was like, Lost Boys, this is all I want to talk about.
That's perfect. Personally, I'm going to go hang out with Chris Sarandon in Fright Night. I have his bat form tattooed on my leg.
Wow.
So that's where I'm going to be at all day.
That's great.
But thank you both so much for talking with
me.
This
is
wonderful.
Great to
I
see you.
Can't wait to see the movie tonight.
Oh, you like
can't
it.
Wait for
oh,
you
I'm going to be very annoying about it. I can't wait.
Please. All right, BJ, any, I guess, final observations here before we go? Any aspects of that conversation that you had that you wanted to highlight or expand upon here?
I mean, I did the interview before I had actually seen it, which was still a very, very fun interview. But now I like to think about all these questions that I have in my head of like, how did you do this? Or, you know, what was the decision behind that? And there are just like, there's just so much layering that goes on in this movie that I wish I would know more about. Like, I love when Abigail tells Dan Stevens's character, hey, you know, you're going to pull this book and it'll reveal the secret wall and that's your way out. And it's, and then there were none, which is a book about people going to an isolated location and people start mysteriously dying and learning there's a killer among them. Like, beautiful chef's kiss. Like, I want to know how those decisions came to be because I just think that it's so, so smart. And there's so many little references littered throughout this movie. Like Dan Stevens's character name is revealed to be Adam Barrett, which is Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett, who most people know from, you know, the Godzilla X Kong that came out that Dan Stevens is in. But also Dan Stevens's first big thing into genre is The Guest, which is written by Simon Barrett, directed by Adam Wingard. So like, that's a really cute thing. And I just want to know how, like, where are all the little Easter eggs? Where are all the pieces? What are the references coming from? Those are things that I want to know, but it's sent me on very fun Wikipedia rabbit holes trying to figure it out for myself.
Yeah, and Hannah Shaw Williams, who works for Slash Film, she's one of the editors there with us. She visited the set of this movie and discovered that Dan Stevens' wardrobe was largely inspired by Tim Robinson in I Think You Should Leave. It's so great. And at one point in this movie, I noticed that a character actually says the words, I think you should leave, out loud. And I was like, oh man, that's got to be like an intentional like verbal call out to that show. So check out Slash Film.
If only there had been a coffin flop. If only.
Yes, exactly. Check out Slash Film for Hannah's set visit coverage. And there's a lot of like cool like trivia stuff that you'll be able to find there if you're a fan of this movie. All right, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about Abigail at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.